Blog Talk Radio.
Young patriot, I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. A young patriot, a term I define, not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it there. Join the young patriots and fight for it there.
Good evening and welcome to the seventh episode of When the World is on Fire, the official podcast of the Young Patriots Organization. I've been forgetting to do this and I'm going to do it this time. This is a call-in show, so if you want to call, the number is 323-843-6094. And the first thing we usually do is go through what's all going on. As a lot of you know, I have moved to Montgomery, Alabama, and a tree fell on my house, which is crazy. I'm okay, and everybody's okay, and they have the house about half rebuilt now. The Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice, which is my cooperative college, we're offering some webinars in September, October, and November. We don't actually have the links up yet, but they'll be up pretty soon. And I want to go through the webinars that we're going to be offering. The title of the semester is Capitalism and Resistance from Global to Local. And in September, we're doing Marxist Urban Economics for Community Organizing, taught by myself, Land, Labor, Capital, Origins, and Fundamentals of Capitalism, taught by Mel Figueroa, who's ABD at Berkeley. In October, we're doing Social Movements and Community Organizing, which I've done a few times. And then Mel is doing the Dismal Science, Economics, Development, and the Industrial World. And in the last month in November, I'll be doing asset-based community development and popular education. And Mel will be doing Here We Go Again, Capitalist Crises and Their Consequences. So it's probably the first semester that we've really done a themed type of semester. And I think all of these really go together. It'll give you a good analysis of economics and development and the way capitalism works and give you some tools on how to resist it. Before we get to the guest today is Matt Keenel. He's the Libertarian candidate for state representative in Michigan, and he's going to be on in about 5 minutes, but I want to tell you a little bit of the story since it is 9/11 today. I was an auto mechanic in the late 90s and the beginning of the 2000s, and one of the reasons that I stopped being an auto mechanic was because of 9/11, and I didn't have the reaction to 9/11 that a lot of other people had, which was, you know, go get them, blah, blah, blah. you know, my reaction was, why would somebody do that? And it didn't, it really didn't make a lot of sense as why, you know, why would people train, learn how to fly planes, and like kill themselves in a fiery explosion knocking down two buildings? That seemed insane to me. And so I decided that I wanted to, you know, figure out what was going on, and that's when I decided to go to college, and I started college in 2002. You know, and what I found out along the way was, you know, these people were pissed off because the United States had been meddling in the Middle East, and, you know, the other 9/11 is also today, which is when Salvador Allende was deposed in a coup, which was backed by Kissinger and the United States, and the United States has a very long history of meddling in other countries' business, and you know, our reaction to 9/11 was to even meddle more, was these expeditionary wars, and you know, we've been in Afghanistan for 18 years, and I don't know if anybody can legitimately tell anybody why we're still there. I have no idea. I don't think anybody knows why we're there besides, you know, some amorphous idea about terrorism. And I just wonder, you know, what is the how are we caring for the troops by putting them in military bases halfway around the world, of which we have about 800 all throughout the world, you know, putting them there in places that they're unfamiliar with, where they don't know the culture, they don't know the language, they don't know the people. And these are young people, for the most part, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds. And, you know, are we really caring for the troops by sending them over there to fight these wars that nobody even knows why we're still fighting? And I wonder, you know, it seems really difficult to disentangle ourselves from this stuff because it's, you know, as Colin Powell said, it's the pottery barn equation. You broke it, you break it, you bought it. So we kind of went into Iraq and we broke Iraq and we went into Afghanistan and we broke Afghanistan. And now we feel like we have to stay there to fix it. And I wonder if we're not just making it worse. And I mean, how many more people have to come back in, if not in boxes, either damaged, either physically or emotionally and mentally? And you know, I have friends who've served in the military, and it's, you know, they seem to have the similar view that I had is that, you know, why are we there? What is the strategy? Is this working? Are we doing anything? And I think young veterans have a very different view. You know, veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have a very different view of war and military power than older veterans do, because older veterans are kind of, as I'm kind of more gung-ho about going in and trying to take over, but younger veterans are like, it's an impossible situation. And it's a really difficult situation to put young people in, and I don't think we're doing them a service, and I think we've responded to 9/11 in exactly the way that, you know, Osama bin Laden and others thought we would respond to 9/11, which is to just try to be a brute and try to take over the world, and you know, leading us to this insane president that we have now. And I wonder if maybe we should not take a step back and, you know, just stop for a minute and think about how insane it is for us to have 800 bases all across the world, and how it's not necessary for our security, because we have allies all over the world. You know, why do we have a military base in Germany? Is Germany a threat to the United States in any way? Why do we have a military base in Japan? You know, there's someplace I can understand, maybe South Korea. Yeah, North Korea could be a threat. Maybe we do get a military base in South Korea, but most of the world, they don't need us. And you know, I just wish we would, you know, and just in a lot of things, let's just stop for a minute and think about what the consequences of our actions are. What are the consequences of 100 years of intervening in other countries and destabilizing their countries, installing right-wing dictators? You know, what are the consequences of that over the long term? Like, people aren't just going to submit. They're going to get pissed off, and they're going to be mad, and you're going to make a lot of enemies. And maybe we should try internationally to make some friends and try to maybe be a real type of leader, you know, in the world. And, you know, we could be a positive force for good, as the Navy slogan says. But, you know, we don't ever seem to be able to do that. We just seem to, you know, destabilize any democratically elected left-wing government. We, you know, trump up excuses for not invading other countries like Iraq. And then, you know, what happens 10 years later? You have ISIS. And ISIS builds the vacuum where there's, you know, no power. It was stable. You know, yes, it was a dictatorship, but it was stable. And ISIS just fills the vacuum there where there's no power. So I just wish we would think more critically and more thoughtfully about our role in the world. Hey Matt, is that you?
Yeah, it's me, Zach. How you doing?
Good. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, how are you doing?
All right, all right. It's been a another crazy day, but, you know, such is life.
Okay, so the first thing I want you to tell me about is I want you to talk about your campaign for state representative in Michigan. Tell us about your platform. Tell us about your opponents. Tell us what you aim to what your goal is for the campaign, and just any sort of relevant information. Basically, just give me your stump speech.
Right on. Yeah. So, honestly, I didn't plan on running this year. I'm just so busy. I work, you know, 60 hours a week typically, at least. And I was planning on running next year for mayor. I still plan on doing that. My wife should be graduated from nursing school, and she should be working. We should be able to have a little bit more time for me to experiment. But I got pressured into it. It was kind of a paper campaign was my plan. You know, Libertarian Party just needed somebody to be on the ballot, and I was able to, you know, afford the $100 and fill out the two pieces of paper and get it in on time. So this was our first ever primary in Michigan for the Libertarian Party. So it created the opportunity that made it easy. Otherwise, you would have a convention and the state party would nominate people. So this time it was a primary, just whoever got in the primary won the nomination, got on the ballot for November. So it created a really cool opportunity. The party was supportive of me running also. It wasn't like I was running without their support. And so I decided to run with it just as a social media campaign. I'm not collecting any donations, not from corporations or people, purely volunteer based. If I have people that are willing to volunteer, you know, I'm going to try to make it out and do as much as I can to spread the word. But really it's more of a way to just shift politics a bit, get a new dialogue going, one that's been missing in politics for a long time. So I've created my platform based on socialist values, mixed with libertarian policy a bit, and even mixed with the progressive policies a bit. And the goal is to just reach people and to get people interested and learning about, you know, just society, because a lot of people don't realize just how flawed it is and how fixable it is. We just work together. So my first platform plank is disarm the police. I think there's a lot of talk about gun control recently. I think gun control against the people typically leads to profiling. It leads to a lot of arrests of minorities. So I say, you know, we do need some gun control. Let's take it from those who are the most violent, that being the police. Statistically, they are the most violent with weapons. So I think we start there. We give the guns out to the community, have the cops train them, maybe. But that's the ideal, is to get the guns out of their hands, to demilitarize them. Second plank would be the deport ICE, is what I call it. Basically advocating for a sanctuary state. And I don't just extend that to ICE. I think we should apply that to any federal agency that's trying to enforce their laws in our region. So that's the one plank. Medicare for All is a plank that You know, as an anarchist, it was tough to reconcile, but understanding the needs of people and the urgency for people to get care and to get out of debt, to me, it makes sense. And it's also something that's pretty publicly accepted and opens the door to these bigger dialogues. Finally, it's abolishing private property. So I'll take a drink here. That's a real packed one, obviously. It's not an achievable one for the position I'm seeking, but it opens up a dialogue. I explain it as, you know, private property is basically what the government permits to be property, and that makes them the ultimate owner. So what I want to see is individuals have more control over their possessions, their belongings, their house, their home. I want workers to have more control over their labor, which means unions, which means ending corporate subsidies and protections, and finally having the community have more control over their resources, which means no pipelines, no Nestle in our waters. So.
Hello?
But yeah, that's about the campaign in a nutshell, I guess. Obviously, we can go into deeper depths of different, like, you know, policies that may be proposed to me while I'm in Congress, but not really my goal to win. My goal is to just open up conversation. So.
Great. Those sound like really excellent. That sounds like a policy platform I could get behind. But so I think the biggest question that I have is, why the Libertarian Party? Why not Socialist SPUSA? Why not the Communist Party? The Libertarian Party is sort of known as, like, you know, bro anarchism, you know, and why did you choose to run in the Libertarian Party as opposed to something else?
It was completely by chance, I guess. You know, I grew up in Macomb County, which is home of the Reagan Democrats. So people unfamiliar with that term, you know, that's like the middle class, you know, blue collar, but, you know, not poverty stricken families, you know, and they
yeah.
sway. And typically they voted for Reagan despite being typically Democrat voters. So it's a unique demographic here. And I was part of it, obviously. So Gary Johnson ran in 2016, and I just saw him to be a great compromise. I knew I didn't like Hillary. I knew I didn't like Trump. So it was just kind of the party I fell into. And I think a lot of it has to do with the abolishment language. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, the anti-war stance was something that really attracted me. So it has its good qualities. But it wasn't until I got in and started being exposed to objectivism and basically social Darwinism from some of these people, like, it started turning me off. It started making me look elsewhere because I didn't feel like these were the people I identify with.
Sure. It's interesting that because I have a libertarian story myself. I went to undergrad at Auburn University. And you probably know that the Mises Institute is across the street from Auburn University down in Auburn. And the most radical people on campus at Auburn were probably the people who hung out at the Mises Institute. And they, you know, they talk about, you know, decriminalization or like legalization of drugs, you know, weapons for all. And there was long, long debates about, you know, between me as a budding Marxist and them as Mises libertarian. There was long debates about the economy, you know, particularly private property. And I'm just curious as to how you have been received into the Libertarian Party, and what are some of the debates that are the most common that you find maybe either the most difficult to deal with or the most common. And, you know, how do you create you know, a tipping point or a critical mass of people within the Libertarian Party to start changing folks' ideas?
Yeah, so I mean, it's been a progression, right? So I got in, and there was just like red flags, you know, where it's like, okay, Gary Johnson, I think, like when it came to the civil rights, you know, they want to repeal the Civil Rights Act, and I couldn't get behind it. Gary Johnson didn't get behind it. But that was the big thing when I came into the party. Even though I was supporting the presidential candidate, I was still getting told I don't belong. You know, you don't belong in this party. Gary Johnson's not a libertarian, all this bullshit. So, you know, it was like I kind of came into it experiencing the hostility. It's just kind of the climate of the party. And I kind of fed on that a bit. I was able to start, you know, recognizing some of the stuff and drawing it out. And, you know, a lot of it is very, like, enabling of racism. They stop drawing a distinction between ideology and reality, where it's like they start protecting these corporations that are built up on the state power they're supposedly against. So those are big things, you know, racism, corporations. Private property has obviously been a big one. I started the rent is theft, basically hashtag, and that kind of took off. But it really drew out, you know, who do you represent? And it turns out they represent the landowners. They don't represent the majority of people that never have the opportunity to own land, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Let's talk about a little bit more about rent is theft, because I think some people will think, well, if I own the land, I should be able to make a living off of that land, in how, or I own a house or whatever, I should, because I own that house, I should be able to make a living off of it. You know, say, you know, I bought a house, I spent my hard-earned money on the house, shouldn't I be able to make a living off of owning that house?
Yeah, no, it's tough. And, you know, they always try to throw it at you that way. You know, you talk about business, they want to talk about small business. You talk about renting, they don't want to talk about these, you know, mega corporations. Some of them aren't even based in the U.S. that own property here and are extorting our people, you know. They buy houses for cheap during recessions. The housing value goes up. Somehow the rent goes up, even though they didn't pay that much. You know what I mean? So it's like, they want to be dismissive of the reality for a lot of people. You know,
sure.
they don't want to face that reality. That's where I say they drift off into this ideological wonderland.
Sure.
where rent is,
sure,
completely ethical, you know.
Sure, and it's interesting that you've said this twice, this ideological wonderland versus reality. Do you find that ideological wonderland to be on the left as well?
Yeah, definitely. You know, so I started the Libertarian Socialist Caucus, helped start it. And I'm definitely the one who's gone the furthest left, I think, in it. And even there, it's the same thing, I feel like, where it's, you know, if you're not reading the right books, or maybe you're reading the right books, but you're not willing to condemn Stalin for murdering a million bazillion people, you know. It's like this,
yeah,
ideological and even historical arguments where I think there is some importance to it, but I think too many people play, you know, gatekeeper with it, and it just splinters everybody off. And, you know, even working in the Libertarian Party, it's, you know, it's about recognizing that these are people in our community, and we need to look out for each other. You know, we need to improve each other's lives and protect each other. So I'm trying to push the unity. But yeah, it gets tough in both circles.
And how do you get from – this is the thing that always frustrates me, is that, you know, I end up in these debates with socialists all the time. And, you know, I'm a community organizer, so, like, I want to know how to get our people fed. I want to know how to get them housed. I want to know how to get them health care, like really practical stuff. Like, that's what I'm interested in. Now, I have radical ideas about how to get there, but those ideas are rooted in some sort of like lived experience and lived reality. And what I end up having discussions. I'm not in libertarian circles, so I have no idea. But I have these discussions in socialist and communist circles where there's like, it's like I don't necessarily disagree with you about what your theory is. I don't necessarily think it's wrong. I just think that maybe we shouldn't be as clear as we are on what should be done, and maybe we should let the people, you know, tell us what should be done. And I wonder what, you know, you've gone from I assume some sort of theory to a practical policy platform, and what's the process like of getting into like real life?
Honestly, it was running for office. You know, you start getting these candidate questionnaires and things like that, and you're forced to sit and think about the reality of it. And, you know, like I said, Gary Johnson drew me in, and because I was a Reagan Democrat, like, he just had that personality. I trusted him, and I identified a lot with him. And, you know, he had a policy where, does this bill, you know, provide more people more liberty? And, you know, that's when you're, like, forced to have that reality check and go, okay, you know, yeah, this isn't my ideological ideal, but this is something that is going to help people, or this is something that is going to hurt people, and I need to oppose it. You know, that's kind of where, I guess, reality check comes in. And, you know, our ideal, for one, it's an ideal, so it is somewhat unrealistic. But also our ideal is that people are organizing and the state is needed. We can't do that by ourselves, you know. So if I can get more people doing that, great. If I can get in office and, you know, fight for the people and fight for their needs, that would be great too. You know, it's about making a difference in the world, and I don't know how you measure that. I don't think it's necessarily measured with political wins.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's measured with political wins, but at the same time, I've been doing this work for over a decade, and I sometimes feel like, oh my God, I just started. Like, I have not, I feel like sometimes I've failed and haven't accomplished anything. I think it's interesting. One of our guests that came on, Mel Figueroa, who's actually a member of the Cooperative Men's School, a faculty owner of the Cooperative Men's School, is going to teach some classes, has been talking about that we live in an era of conjuncture, which is a Gramsci theory, which is the idea that economic crisis leads to political polarization. So we live in a country and really a world where you see fascism rising all over the world, but you also see far left wing, more socialist type stuff also rising all over the world. There was a left wing candidate elected president of Mexico. You know, it's rising all over the world. And I wonder if you could comment about that, and also about where you see yourself as a candidate in that high degree of political polarization.
Yeah, so, I mean, especially in America, it's, you know, the politics has swung so far right. And, you know, I feel like, the major parties, you know, they do that on purpose, and they steer people a certain way, but it's really a fight for that center, you know, and it's the center that, for better or worse, has the power a lot of times when it comes to deciding elections. So I feel like the center, quote unquote, you know, like those are rather apolitical people. They're obviously interested enough, but a lot of people aren't even interested. You know, I think it's a lot more about the social gains, and that's where I think social media is really helping, because we're able to communicate and to get people thinking about these things. And
sure.
To me, that's really about where I'm at with my politics. It's like my community is divided. We have the North End and the South End. You know, it's poor on one side. It's, you know, rather middle class, upper middle class on the other side. The South Side has no representation, and they're pitted against each other. You know, the people want to keep up their home values, so they're calling the zoning department to kick people out. They're calling calling the cops when people are having parties. So it's like, that's where I think society's really lacking, is that we just depend on these things. We don't question it. We just, when people get shot by the police out here, they just chalk it up as, well, that, you know, it was that person's fault. It wasn't the cop's fault. You know, they can do no wrong. So those are really the areas where I want to try to reach the average person, you know, in my community, and get them to recognize each other's struggles.
Sure. So, and I think I got this wrong. I said state representative, but you're going to the House of Representatives. That's where you're running. That's correct.
Yeah, it would be the State House of Representatives here in Michigan.
Okay, the State House of Representatives. I wonder if you could comment some on, you know, you saw the guy in Florida who is running, ran on a progressive ticket and won the primary kind of out of nowhere. You have a black woman who's candidate for governor in Georgia. You have Ocasio Cortez in New York, you have Bernie Sanders, you have Nina Turner, you have this rising left wing, which is not really that left, it's social democrats, but it's left for the United States. What do you make of all that? Is that a real movement? Is that the effect of some more radical organizing that's even more radical than that? What is your take on that phenomenon?
Yeah, I think it's partly caused by the generational gap, where young people today don't have as many opportunities as our parents had, you know, to just graduate high school and get a well-paying job and have a house and a family. So I think a lot of that is the youth movement rising up and taking responsibility. I think millennials have been, you know, disinterested. They haven't been voting or anything like that. I think these coming elections, we're going to see them take more of an action. And I think socialism is just, it makes sense once it's presented to you and once you're growing up in these conditions that, you know, cause you to basically slave your life away. And if not, you end up, you know, in jail or killed, or, you know, you never know what will happen if you're part of that surplus population. So it's, I think people are, the young people are going to be the ones to rise up, and I see it even more with the next generation. They're even more radical and left-wing than the millennials, so I think a lot of people don't believe in voting, but I think if we actually give them reasons to vote, they will vote, and, you know, I think what the progressives are doing, DSA is backing that a lot. I'm in the DSA also. You know, I think it's cool. But the major parties are still an elitist party. Like those
yeah.
People, they don't have 9-to-5 jobs. They, you know, they take the whole campaign season off. They get, you know, time to do everything they need to do, and they have to raise all this money just to compete in the primary. Where third party, you know, like I said, it was $100 and I was on the ballot. So.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. What you say about young people and millennials and younger generations, because I taught in college, and when I taught at UAB, my students were chomping at the bit for like political analysis, critical analysis, what is socialism, what are these options. You know, I had a guest speaker from Black Lives Matter, I had a guest speaker from the Young Patriots Organization, and I had a guest speaker from the Republican Party. And, you know, my students were just really engaged, plugged in. And it's really interesting because the generation that I was teaching, who are 18, 19, 20, and 21 right now, you know, they lived their entire life plugged into the internet. You know, they don't know a time when you weren't plugged, and they know so much stuff. They don't necessarily have the theoretical tools to be able to analyze the stuff, but they know so much stuff. And I think, you know, with what DSA is doing, and at DSA, you know, I've heard some people criticize them because they're sort of, you know, social democratic and not really anti-capitalist, not, you know, specifically anti-capitalist, but they have really accomplished a lot in a short amount of time. And I agree with you. I think there's going to be waves of progressive, young progressive candidates. And I think we're seeing just the first trickle of those waves. In 2020, you're going to see an even bigger wave. In 2022, you're going to see an even bigger wave. In 2024, I mean, I think by the time you get to 2024, you're going to have such a large, young, progressive base that's politically engaged that unless they just use COINTELPRO to destroy it, I think you're going to see a very large change in American society.
Right.
You think so?
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, too. And, like, you know, part of my campaign really is just to show how easy it is. You know, I mean, obviously I don't have any funding. I'm just, you know, just in my community where when I can make it out, I make it out. I talk to my neighbors. Obviously I'm decently known, you know, just from living here and, being a social person. So it doesn't take much, you know what I mean? Like, just me and,
yeah.
A keyboard is achieving a whole lot more than I ever dreamed was possible. So anybody could do it. And then I just want to encourage others to do it, because I'm sure there's ones that are better and could do better than me. So.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what you can do on social media, because we started 2011. We didn't even know what we were doing. And we started using social media to try to push anti-development, anti-gentrification narrative in Birmingham, and we succeeded in getting that out into the public, like, really dramatically. And you know, I just recently did a video about Randall Woodfin, who was an Our Revolution candidate and became a centrist when he got into office. He abandoned all of his progressive things that he promised us to do, and that video got over 4,000 views. It had like 10,000 posts reach, and it's just like, you just can almost, if you know how to do it right, you can almost instantaneously create a narrative that just gets out into the world. And I don't even think we've scratched the surface of what can be done on social media, because it's just like, just a little bit of planning and a little bit of strategy, you can really change narratives pretty quickly. Do you what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's where social media really creates an opportunity for people who don't have funding to push narratives like that. You know, it's a way to connect, and I think the big you know, providers are recognizing that, and they keep trying to, you know, put stops on that, but we keep innovating and we keep finding ways to stay in touch and spread information. And then, yeah, what I'm finding too is, you know, being a candidate, just being a candidate elevates your voice, you know. People in this society put politicians on a pedestal. And I noticed that when Brian Ellison ran his Arm the Homeless campaign. He's running for U.S. Congress here. And he started Arm the Homeless campaign. He started a GoFundMe. He was going to raise so much money to get shotguns in the arms of the homeless. And it was really, you know, it was a marketing tool. And he went on with a suit and tie and explained on Fox News how, gun laws have made it so that homeless people here, if you don't have a registered address, you can't have a concealed weapons permit, so you can only open carry, which obviously a shotgun is just not practical for somebody who doesn't have a home.
Sure.
And how they're, and it drew out, you know, the biases against the homeless, where, you know, even the liberals were, you know, assuming they had drug problems, assuming they had mental problems. And, you know, Brian went on there and said, you know, it could happen to anybody. It could happen to him. It could happen to me overnight with the wrong series of circumstances happen. You know, it's not anything to do with mental capacity. It's the society we live in. So it's just really cool how much more attention that gets as opposed to just a guy on the corner with a blowhorn. And
yeah.
I think that's a valid way to educate, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a great education, too. We got a call, so I'm going to put them on the line. Hey, caller, this is Zach. Do you have a question for Matt?
Yeah, Matt, I was wondering what you think about the North Korean government.
What side do you believe, I guess, as far as North Korean propaganda versus U.S. propaganda?
There's definitely some propaganda there. Oh, I thought you were asking me. Sorry.
Yeah, no, but that's my opinion, is that you could look at it from both directions, but only people there probably know what's going on. Otherwise, my foreign policy is that we should not ever get involved or interfere with their government.
Okay, and as a follow-up, so I heard you got kicked off of Dankertarians today, and I was wondering why you called the Libsox who run that capitalists. I'll hang up and listen.
I wondered if we would get a caller like that.
It's impossible just because libertarians, but I'll go into it real quick. So yeah, a bunch of people from the Libsox caucus staged a coup today, 9/11, almost in remembrance of Pinochet, and kicked me off of a page I helped create and turned into basically the left-wing media for the Libertarian Party. I call them that because I think most of them have been entrenched in the party. They're much more concerned with winning the support of the party. I think that's a flaw of the party, and maybe not even specifically libertarians, but where people get into these parties and try to win respect within the party, where to me that's just a useless waste of time. We should be trying to reach people, and they don't want to reach people. They want to just please each other and talk about their fantasy worlds together and exclude people, and I think that's just not a winning strategy for politics.
And I think what you're saying is a problem with party politics in general, in the sense that the party politics become about the party and don't become about politics, which politics is about power, and power is the power for people. And so my specific political flavor is autonomous. I'm an autonomous, and autonomous don't believe in any sort of organized party at all. But specifically because of that, and you see this happening in the Democratic Party right now, you have the majority of Democrats who are polled favor socialism, and the establishment Democrats are defending their neoliberal centrist territory because of no other reason, because that's what they believe the party should be, and the party is not responding to the needs of the people. And the whatever party there is, if there is to be politics, is to be party, they should be responding to what the people want. So I would say that's probably common to any party politics, and it sort of makes me question, should we have political parties at all?
Yeah, no, I know it. To me, that's what you have going on in the LP is a lot of people just trying to please each other and to keep this small ideological idea, that these small group of men created. And I think that's just flawed. And you kind of touched on it earlier when you said, what do you advocate, your ideals, or do you listen to people and find out their needs, And I think that's where we really differ. Me and the people I'm having an issue with is they don't want to listen to other people. They don't want to represent them. They know what's best for them, and they're going to tell them what's best for them. And, I don't think that gets you anywhere. You've got to have, something that's going to speak to people. The best thing that we could ever be is a representative of the people. That's the best thing anyone running for office could be,
Right. So we have about 15 minutes left, and I ask this to all of my So feel free to expound on this at length if you want to, but I ask this of everybody who comes on. And my question is, what is your hope and vision for the future?
My hope and vision? You know, I struggle with reality, but, you know, I try to be optimistic. You know, I think it's going to take time, but I think we can get past this destructive phase. You know, I think if we can convince people to, you know, boycott the military, boycott the police, lay down their weapons, transform the way we organize into ways that benefit everybody, I think that's possible. That's my ideal. You know, I try not to exclude, though. You know, some people need to be pushed back against because they're committing some of these atrocities and think they're moral about it. But I have hope. I think, like I said, a younger generation here coming up, I think they're going to be on the right track more than we were starting out. So I'm excited about the future. And it looks bleak to some, and it's absolutely killing others, and we got to recognize that and do something about it. So.
Yeah, I'm positive about the future. I know some people are. Some people think it's just all falling apart, and especially like new activists and organizers who are just now sort of looking at the world and are like, oh my God, this shit is so fucked up. And I think after you've done it for a while, if you've been in it for a while, you sort of realize that it's been fucked up for a really long time. And, you know, maybe forever, maybe it's always been fucked up. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that I have is hope. And like, Cornel West always talks about, he's not optimistic, but he has hope. And, you know, I see the stuff that's happening today and I've never seen it before. Like, as far as stuff that's happening on the left, the interest in leftist politics, the rise of DSA, and the really encouraging action on the far left in anarchist and socialist and communist circles. And there's more people involved in that stuff now than I have ever seen before in my entire life. And it's really encouraging. I think there's a lot of flaws to it. I think DSA is a pretty good central representative because I think they're pretty practical. And, you know, you might need the ideologues to drive the narrative, but you need the practical people to pass the policies. And I think in the past, the people in the center have been rigidly ideological and there hasn't been as much policies passed as could have been possible. And every policy that gets passed is a compromise. And there's people who, you know, don't want to compromise. And I understand that. Like, I understand, but understand that there's an ecology of progressive activism in which some people play a role of pushing the needle to the left and other people play the role of nailing down the policy that's, you know, a little bit further left than it used to be. And that's what the Republicans and the conservatives have been good at doing for, you know, years and years and years. They've brought in all their radicals and said, yeah, do your thing. And then they've managed to move the needle steadily to the right since, you know, 1970. So, and I see that strategy starting to emerge on the left, and I just hope the infighting doesn't destroy it.
Yeah, I mean, I was around 10 years ago in politics, you know, following the Ron Paul campaign. But anyways, so socialism was a bad word, you know what I mean? Like, nobody used socialism unless it was a slur against somebody. And for what you have now, how accepted it is. You know, Jim Carrey just came out and endorsed it, and people want to attack him and go, he's a liberal, but he's talking about it. He's claiming it. He's going to learn. We got to give people time. And also, you know, socialism has been ineffectual in politics for a couple decades here in American politics, at least. And I kind of related to this. I kind of related to like the state party here of libertarians, right? When I came in, they were against the anarchists. They were just like these moderates. They would actually kick out our members and block them from the convention and stuff like that. It took a year, but we built up enough anarchists, got them to the state convention that we were able to block a 7/8 vote. You know, we had just over an 1/8 vote to block a former governor candidate from getting a delegate spot and that won us respect. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
We got to be realistic about our goals. We got to recognize that even though that wasn't a win, it's still a win, you know?
Yeah, it's more power. Like, it's and that stuff is incremental. Hang on, we got a caller. I'm going to put him on.
Okay. Hey.
Hey, caller.
Oh,
hey,
man.
Caller, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me on. I just thought it was interesting because I've been following Mr. Kendall's career, and it seems to me that he's done a lot to conflate libertarian socialism with authoritarian socialism. And so I wonder, how do you draw the distinction between authoritarianism and libertarianism?
Okay, we got about 10 minutes left. I'm gonna put you back on mute, and I'll let him answer, and then we're probably going to have to wrap up.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. You totally suck, Kendall. Take care.
So, socialism is anti-authoritarian anyways, right? It's about democracy. It's about equality, providing equality, you know. So I think where people want to call it authoritarian socialism, either they're equating it to some big bad boogeyman that the CIA probably invented, or, you know, they're talking about just trying to put things into practical policy. Libertarians want to be so, you know, dichotomatic, or however you want to say it. Like, it's black or white. It's authoritarian or it's statism. Where, like I said, when you start looking at practical policy and making people's lives better, Medicare for all, they'll call that authoritarian socialism. But that, to me, that's a defense. Like, people are hurting. It's because of the system we have. I'm not going to call that authoritarianism. I'm going to call that practical, and that's something that's on the table that I could support if I got into office. So I think that's where it gets conflated. Also, I think, you know, they don't quite understand socialism. They understand libertarianism. They understand individualist anarchism and maybe even market anarchism, but they don't understand socialism, the way socialist organizing works regarding unions and municipalities and communities working together as democracies. They want to call that a state, where I think, you know, as long as it's respecting individual rights, nobody would opt out. That would be a voluntary thing. You'd want to be part of a community thriving. So.
Yeah, and here's the thing about, I'm an anarchist, but the thing about the economics of healthcare is that it doesn't work unless there's a large pool of sick and healthy people together, because the healthy people have to subsidize the sick people because the sick people could never pay for their own bills, whereas the healthy people, they can pay for their own bills. And, you know, in theory, you say, well, I want a local community cooperative for healthcare, but with the cost, with the way health, with how much healthcare costs, and you have to have the scale in order to, you have to have the scale of the economics in order to be able to support everybody in the group. And it's just, you know, like, I'm a sick person, I have bipolar disorder, and there's no way that I could ever pay for my health care just myself. Like, I have to have healthy people subsidizing me to pay for my health care. I'm gonna put one more caller, but I think this is a return caller. We got about 5 minutes left, so let me put them back on.
All right.
Hey, Matt, you said once that you think landlords deserve the law. Do you still think that?
So I got in a Twitter argument. I got a Twitter argument, and I don't know, some guy was, like, rallying against communism, and he said something about some great aunt, blah, 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 that, I don't know, apparently died in Ukraine, and I was just tired of the guy, and I was like, were they a landlord? If so, they deserved the wall. And, you know, it was tongue-in-cheek. It was joking. But I am against landlordism, and I make no apologies for landlords. I try not to focus on the mom-and-pop. Obviously, they're not the biggest problem. I think banks owning 13 million homes and keeping them off the market to inflate that value and to create that scarcity are a much bigger issue. But I think, especially if you're going to call yourself a libertarian and say you're anti-authoritarian, landlordism is inherently authoritarian, it requires you having some kind of, you know, private police force, court, whatever you want to call it, but it's going to take authority where, you know, nobody should want to rule over somebody's house. Everybody should feel safe and secure in their home. Everybody should have a home. So I make no apologies for being against landlords.
I listen to this show, and it's a sports talk radio show, and it's crazy. It's absolutely nuts. It started in Birmingham, Alabama. It's called the Paul Feinbaum Show. It's wildly popular, and they have all these crazy callers that call in. And I would say that this episode of When the World is on Fire is the most like the Paul Feinbaum Show of any episode that I've ever done. And I am extremely proud of that. I am extremely proud of that. So that makes me very happy. So maybe we should definitely have you come on again. I enjoy the banter.
Yeah, no, I enjoy talking to Zach. I appreciate you having me on. And, yeah, either before the election happens or afterwards, I could give you the feedback or whenever. So.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks for coming on. You got any last words for us?
A lot of people get mad at me because I won't toe party lines, but I'm not going to shut up. I know what's reaching the people that I want to reach, and I'm listening to people's needs, and I'm representing them as fairly as I can, and I'm not going to be bullied out of this party or any party. So, that's my final word for the people if they're calling in to troll.
All right, Matt. Thanks for coming on, man.
All right. Thanks, Zach.
I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others because we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. Patriot, a term I define, not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join.